We're reading from Ruth 3, which is page 269, if you've got the church Bibles. Ruth 3. Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, "My daughter, should I not seek rest for you, as it may be well with you? Is not Boaz our relative with whose young women you were? See, he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. Wash therefore and anoint yourself, and put on your cloak, and go down to the threshing floor, but do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. But when he lies down, observe the place where he lies. Then go and uncover his feet and lie down, and he will tell you what to do." And she replied, "All that you say I will do." So she went down to the threshing floor and did just as her mother-in-law had commanded her. And when Boaz had eaten and drunk and his heart was merry, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain. Then she came softly and uncovered his feet and lay down. At midnight the man was startled and turned over, and behold, a woman lay at his feet. He said, "Who are you?" And she answered, "I am Ruth, your servant. Spread your wings over your servant, for you are a redeemer." And he said, "May you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. You have made this last kindness greater than the first, in that you have not gone after young men, whether poor or rich. And now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you all that you ask, for all my fellow townsmen know that you are a woman, worthy woman. And now it is true that I am a redeemer, and there is a redeemer nearer than I. Remain tonight, and in the morning, if he will redeem you, good, let him do it. But if he is not willing to redeem you, then as the Lord lives, I will redeem you. Lie down until the morning." So she lay at his feet until the morning, but arose before one could recognize another. And he said, "Let it not be known that the woman came to the threshing floor." And he said, "Bring the garment you are wearing and hold it out." So she held it, and he measured out 6 measures of barley and put it on her. Then she went into the city. And when she came to her mother-in-law, she said, "How did he fare, my daughter?" Then she told her all that the man had done for her, saying, "These 6 measures of barley he gave to me, for he said to me, 'You must not go back empty-handed to your mother-in-law.'" She replied, "Wait, my daughter, until you learn how the matter turns out, for the man will not rest but will settle the matter today." Amen.
Thanks, thank you very much indeed. I've got these here and I don't know what they're for. What are those? They're for you, Pete. Happy Christmas. Are those yours, Josh? No. He doesn't know what they are either. No one knows what those are. Well, we're carrying on this fantastic story of Ruth. As we begin, let me pray. Pray for each of us as we engage with the Bible now. Let me pray. God, our Father, as we've already heard this evening, your word likens us to sheep, and that means we can often be very stupid and gullible, and we can nibble our ways and our way into lostness. And we can drift away from you, and we can drift away from being the people you want us to be. We can drift in our relationships with each other. We can drift in our godliness. We can drift in knowing you. And so please, as we listen to the Bible now, as we engage again with this story of Ruth, please would you be a good shepherd to us by your word. Would you lead us into understanding you and knowing you better, so that we do live with Jesus as our Lord and our Saviour. And we ask it in his name. Amen. Well, if you've not been here the last couple of weeks as we've engaged with this story of Ruth, just a brief catch-up as to where we've got to. In the story so far, we've been very much aware that it's a story of knowing God who is in control of our lives, and knowing God is absolutely kind as well. And in this story, it's a story of a family who struggled big time through all sorts of difficult and harsh circumstances. It's a family that meandered and found a way of just departing from God's best purposes for them. It's a story that begins with a sense of rebellion and sin against God. It's a story that's marked by really desperate sadness, desperate pain, as this woman, Naomi, her husband dies, and her two boys, they've got married in this land of Moab, and they die too. So they're far away from home. She left the land of Bethlehem, the place of Bethlehem, the house of bread. That's what it literally means. And goes to this enemy country, this land of Moab, and is just hit with just agonizing disaster in her life. And she hears that there's food back at the house of bread again. And so she decides to head home. And one of her daughter-in-laws, Ruth, goes all the way with her and returns with her to Bethlehem again. At the harvest time, they return back to the house of bread when there is bread. And Ruth, her daughter-in-law, has made this incredible confession of faith. She's from this people that were idolatrous and were involved in all sorts of very, very unhelpful things that related to their religion. And she'd left all those idols behind. And she said to her mother-in-law, you know, your God will be my God. Your people will be my people. So she ventures to this land that humiliates, it's the enemy territory for her. So she arrives back in Bethlehem, and neither of these widows know what the future holds for them. Neither of them do. In fact, it's pretty bleak at the end of chapter 1. And then into chapter 2, we find that they take advantage of God's given social security system in the Old Testament in those days, where at harvest times farmers weren't to harvest at the very edge of the field, but to leave gleanings and leave the edge of the field for the widow, for the poor, for the orphan. And so Ruth sets out and gleans in the field, and Naomi doesn't. I think in chapter 2 we do get a sense that Naomi is still quite stuck emotionally and paralyzed. I think she's marked by some of those things we talked about earlier on when we spoke about hope. I think there's depression there. There's this futility. There's this despair. Things do seem hopeless for her. What is the way through? And I can relate. As we go through this story of Ruth, it's Naomi that I relate to most in the story. But as we go through chapter 2, we suddenly find that she's increasingly aware that God has not departed from her. God is still very kind and looking out for her and loves her and actually provides for her materially. And in chapter 2 as well, we get an indication that there may well be someone, this guy Boaz, who could come into their family life as a kinsman redeemer, as it were, and begin to really, really figure things out and provide security for them both. Naomi's thinking has changed. Look at chapter 3, look at verses 1 and 2 as we begin this third chapter. Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to Ruth, the daughter-in-law, my daughter, should I not seek rest for you, that it may be well with you? Is not Boaz our relative, with whom whose young women you were? See, he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. So Naomi actually begins to strategize and think in a much more positive way than she has been doing so far. If you look back at chapter 2 and verse 20, there's this quite a tremendous change in her attitude. She seems to be marked by hope now, whereas before things did seem very, very hopeless for her. So in verse 20, she said this, Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, may he be blessed by the Lord, whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead. There was a sense in which she thought that God's kindness had forsaken her and her dead husband and boys. And now she's really realizing, well, perhaps he hasn't. He hasn't forsaken. And he's begun to provide through this guy, Boaz. And I just want to say that families are important in the Bible. And the ways that families work in the Old Testament is in the backdrop to what goes on here in Ruth chapter 3. So just to get a little bit of the background, God has a high priority on family. He provides for widows and for orphans for their security, and he does it in a particular way in the Old Testament. So if you just turn back, keep your place in Ruth chapter 3, just turn back to page 200 in the church Bible. So Deuteronomy chapter 25. And verses 5 to 10. This is kind of like helps to give some of the backdrop so we can understand what's going on with this guy Boaz in chapter 3 of Ruth. If brothers dwell together and one of them dies and has no son, the wife of the dead man shall not be married outside the family to a stranger. Her husband's brother shall go in to her and take her as his wife and perform the duty of her husband's brother to her. And the first son whom she bears shall succeed the name, not of the name of the new husband, but the name of his dead brother, that his name may not be blotted out of Israel. And if the man does not wish to take his brother's wife, then his brother's wife shall go up to the gates to the elders and say, "My husband's brother refuses to perpetuate his brother's name in Israel. He will not perform the duty of a husband's brother to me." Then the elders of his city shall call him and speak to him. And if he persists, saying, "I do not wish to take her," then his brother's wife shall go up to him in the presence of the elders and pull his sandal off. I don't know what that means, by the way. Pull his sandal off his foot and spit in his face. I think I know what that means. That'll do for him. The shame on him, as it were. And she shall answer and say, "So shall it be done to the man who does not build up his brother's house. And the name of his house shall be called in Israel, the house of him who has had his sandal pulled off." It's not the kind of surname you want, is it? It's a shaming thing that goes on there. But the point is to provide security for a widow and actually to extenuate the name of somebody so their name is not blotted out. Names are very important in the book of Ruth. They're very important in the Bible. So come back to Ruth chapter 3. So what seems strange a little bit to us, it isn't so strange actually in the context of what's going on in this time in this part of Israel's history. Ruth's husband Mahlon is dead. Ruth is childless, and Naomi has no other son, and so Naomi's next of kin is obliged to marry Ruth and therefore secure her future, secure her financially, and to provide for her a son who would have Mahlon's name, and Mahlon's name would continue. And that's what's going on. Look back at chapter 2, verse 20 again. I read the first half a moment ago. Naomi also said to her, the second part of verse 20, "The man is a close relative of ours, one of our redeemers, one of our kinsmen redeemers." All right, so that's the backdrop to Ruth chapter 3. That's what's going on here. The question in our mind is, how does Ruth catch her man? That's at the human level what's going on in the story here. How does Ruth catch her man? And there are just two very simple things that I want to draw out of this chapter, out of this part of the story. And they both relate to God being trustworthy. You know, the series we've called Knowing God. Knowing God is trustworthy. That means, firstly, we can afford to be very ordinary. He's trustworthy, so we can be ordinary. Secondly, God is trustworthy, so we can afford to be godly. God is trustworthy, so we can afford to be godly. Let's just look at that first thing I want to draw out. God is trustworthy, so we can be ordinary. Naomi has a plan. And it might seem a little bit unusual to us, a little bit extraordinary to us, but it's actually quite a straightforward plan that she has. Look at what she does, verse 2 of chapter 3. He's not Boaz, a relative with whose young women you were. See, he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. Wash, therefore, and anoint yourself, and put on your cloak and go down to the threshing floor, but do not make yourself known to the man until he's finished eating and drinking. But when he lies down, observe the place where he lies, then go and uncover his feet and lie down, and he will tell you what to do. See, Ruth, Naomi has a plan, and up to a certain point, it's kind of like a little bit in her control. You know, Ruth, you get on down to the threshing floor, observe where Boaz is, and then go and lie at his feet. Then, well, who knows? He'll tell you what to do, all right? Beyond that, we don't know, all right? And Ruth ventures forward, and I think there's a vulnerability about Ruth still here in the story, I think the story allows us at this point to think of Ruth actually possibly reacting in this way. Thank you very much, Naomi. You know, here's me taking the risks again. That's what's happened in chapter 2. Ruth has gone out as a Moabitess into the fields as a single young woman, into the fields around to glean, and Boaz is very concerned about her security. She was in a very vulnerable situation, and Boaz has to say to her, stick near my young men, and I told them not to harm you. Stick near my young women as they go about gleaning. And here she is, and she could say, well, thanks very much, Naomi. Here's me going out again, venturing forth and taking the risk. That is not how she responds, though. That is not how she responds. Look at verses 5 and 7. And she replied, all that you say, I will do. So she went down to the threshing floor and did just as her mother-in-law had commanded her. And when Boaz had eaten and drunk, and his heart was merry, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain. Then she came softly and uncovered his feet and lay down. Basically what's going on here, that there are other connotations going on in the story. They're not very strong, but I think they are there. The uncovering of Boaz's feet, his legs, is, there are sexual connotations here. And in reality, what she is saying is, marry me. Marry me. There's Boaz, he's sleeping, hard day's work. He's had some wine, we're told, he was merry. And he's lying there by the heap of barley. And suddenly, there's a woman at his feet, well, something at his feet, and he's shocked. And he wakes up and he thinks, oh, you know, who are you? That's what verse 8 is happening there. At midnight, the man was startled and turned over, and behold, a woman lay at his feet. And then Ruth basically puts into words what she said actually by her body language. She's acted out, take me under your wing, as she gets under the blanket. She then actually puts it into words. Would you just notice that this is the first time that Ruth in the story is not referred to as Ruth the Moabitess, as Ruth the servant. So there's a trajectory that Ruth is on in the story as she becomes more and more a part of God's people. And if we get to the end of the book, we'll be astonished at how far she goes in amongst God's people. And she makes this confident claim on Boaz as her kinsman redeemer. If you look back at chapter 2 and verse 12, Boaz had said to Ruth, or prayed concerning Ruth, may you find shelter under the Lord's wings. And now Ruth in verse 9 literally says, spread your wing over me, Boaz. Be the means of the Lord's blessing. Be my protector, marry me, answer your own prayer. That's what's going on there. Answer your own prayer. Now this might seem strange to us, but I think the context of what folks were able to do in those days with a kinsman redeemer, and you've got Naomi hatching a very simple plan, a very ordinary plan, a very ordinary plan to see things done right. It's all in the context. She knows, Naomi knows that the Bible talks about, you know, the Old Testament, the law of God talks about a kinsman redeemer. She knows that there's something for her to claim here. So she takes initiative and acts in a very ordinary way. And God is at work in loving kindness through this story. He's at work and kindly at work through sin and rebellion. He's kindly and wonderfully at work through desperate sadness and hopelessness and despair. Here we heard in chapter 2 how he's wonderfully kindly at work through chance events. You know, Ruth just happened to go into the right field at the right time. Behold, Boaz, the right guy, turns up just as she's there in the field. God is at work now in Naomi's very ordinary planning. And I think there's a call for us to trust God. To try to be the God of this story. To be a God who's overseeing and kindly overseeing our lives and all the little incidences in them. And we can actually make our plans in a very ordinary way. We can take advice from friends if we've got to make a decision. We do not have to sit back and wait for visions and dreams and for God to write stuff across the sky. God's right there with us, figuring stuff out with us in chance events and in ordinary decisions made in just normal, wise, godly ways. And we must trust God to be a God, not just a God of the miraculous and the gaps. You know, God is not just active when something, whoa, happens. He wouldn't be God if he was only acting then, at a time of miracle. No, he's God all the time. He's always acting and always loving and always helping us figure things out as we trust him and walk through life knowing him. You know, the insurance companies say, you know, and refer to acts of God, don't they? You know, hit by a bolt of lightning, an act of God. Well, the Bible says the ordinary things, the little accident you have in the car, that the insurance company doesn't think is an act of God, yet God is involved. And maybe we should start claiming a little bit more from our insurance companies and saying it's an act of God. I don't know. I didn't say that this morning. This is a little suggestion for someone to figure out. The question is, will we trust him? In reality, guidance is God's problem, not ours. Guidance is God's problem, not ours. He's sovereign. We can afford to be ordinary. What is your next decision? What are you thinking about doing? What are you planning? What are you hoping? You can afford to be ordinary about the whole thing. Secondly, God is trustworthy, so we can be godly. We can afford to be godly. Naomi and Ruth take the initiative here, and Boaz's response, we don't know how he's going to respond, but at the point we've got to in the story. But they trust that to God. They trust the future to God, and they act in a way that they can act. And they make a claim on godly stuff, I think, in a godly way. And in one sense, Boaz, when we come to him, he cannot believe his luck. You know, there's a woman right at his feet. And what a wife Ruth would make. Verse 10. He acknowledges that. May you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. You have made this last kindness greater than the first, in that you have not gone after young men, whether poor or rich. Boaz sees Ruth's kindness to him as greater than the kindness that he saw demonstrating to her mother-in-law back in chapter 2 and verse 10. And Ruth has chosen him, not run after younger men. And, you know, the Proverbs is a great book in the Bible about wisdom. And it ends with Proverbs chapter 31, which is a chapter about a wise wife and a noble and a godly wife. And please don't take this as an insult. It's all women here. But Proverbs 31 says, you know, a noble and a godly wife, who can find? You know, the assumption is they're rare. And I'm sure if it was talking about a noble and a godly husband, I guess it would say they're even rarer. All right. But Ruth is a Proverbs 31 woman in the making. And she's a young woman, and she's smelling good. She's put stuff on herself, hasn't she? And she's at his feet. You know, this is stuff that men dream of. The reality is, this story happens in the time of the judges. And if you look through the story of Judges sometimes, and just look at the way that women are treated in the time of the judges, you will be shocked and appalled. It's foul. It's horrific. It's disgusting. It's terrible. And here is a guy, and here is a moment that stands out as absolute gem. Here is something different. Here is a man who has every opportunity to take advantage. And he doesn't do it. He doesn't. He holds back. And he is godly. You know, he could take advantage of Ruth. He could marry her and just get on with it. But no, he doesn't. He says, hang on. There's somebody else who's a closer kinsman redeemer than me. He plays it by the book. He plays it by the law. He does the right thing. He could lose the opportunity of Ruth being his wife and himself being her husband by saying, no, there's somebody else. He's godly. He's keen. He lets Ruth know. He could take advantage, but he doesn't do that. Look at verse 12 and verse 13. And now it is true that I am a redeemer, yet there is a redeemer nearer than I, who remain tonight and in the morning. If he will redeem you, good, let him do it. But if he is not willing to redeem you, then as the Lord lives, I will redeem you. Lie down until the morning. Someone else has a prior claim. I think there's something very strong going on here. In Ruth comes to this guy, to Boaz, and says, take me under your wing. And Boaz's godly response is basically could be summarized in this way. I am under God's wing. I'm under his care. I'm under his authority and I'm under his leading. There's a contrast here with Elimelech at the start of the story, whose name means my God is king, who basically didn't do a godly thing. And here is Boaz doing something very different indeed. Instead of taking advantage or instead of figuring things out for his own ends, he sees himself under the Lord's wings. And so we end chapter 3. Boaz goes on being generous to Ruth and Naomi, verse 15. And he said, bring the garment you are wearing, hold it out. So she held it out, and he measured out 6 measures of barley and put it on her. Then she went into the city. Ruth gets home. Naomi is obviously itching ears to hear the results of the plan that she's hatched, and she sends Ruth off to go and do, verse 16 and 17. And when she came back to her, mother-in-law said, how did you fare, my daughter? And she told her all that the man had said and done for her, saying, these 6 measures of barley he gave to me, for he said to me, you must not go back empty-handed to your mother-in-law. So the chapter kind of comes to an end with real blessing and confirmation that Naomi's words, the God of kindness, had not forgotten her at the end of chapter 3, is absolutely true. Her faith is in the right place. But we don't know what's going to end yet. We've not got through to chapter 4. The future is out of Ruth's hands, it's out of Naomi's hands, it's out of Boaz's hands. It's all hanging in the balance. It's not kind of they lived happily ever after anymore. Verse 18, she replied, this is Naomi to Ruth, wait, my daughter, until you learn how the matter turns out, for the man will not rest, but will settle the matter today. So I'm saying to us today, wait a week, because we're not going to figure out how the matter is sorted out until next Sunday. But I think there is something of an application there for us. We've got a chapter 3, end of chapter 3 in this story. I don't know what chapter you are at in your life, whether you're in chapter 48 or chapter 4. Whatever it is, we're heading into another week, and you do not know, and I do not know, what the next chapter in our lives holds. Folks over here just finished A-levels, GCSEs. Got some plans, but we don't know. Got folks just starting new work in a hospital in August. That's you, Tony, yeah? Folks just come back from New York over there, wondering about your future, Debbie. We don't know what the future holds. We've got Christchurch Walkley shaping up slowly. We do not know what the first chapter of Christchurch Walkley is going to be, let alone the fourth chapter. Christchurch Central, we're just kind of like figuring out where we are. And we do not know what the future holds. But I want to say we must gird up our hearts and encourage each other with Ruth chapter 3. God is lovingly in charge. We can afford to be really quite ordinary in an exciting way because we can be godly. We can be adventurous in our godliness. And Ruth, in a sense, she ventured out into the night, and it was an adventure for her. Naomi has been proactive. And she's making decisions that may not pan out. She might get bruised in all of this yet, but she's walking in faith with real courage in God. I think with real godliness. You know, God is in control. He does love us. We can afford to be godly. We can afford to be godly with our taxes and filling in our tax forms. And we don't have to try and grab more. We don't have to try and fiddle things. We can just be honest. We can be honest and godly in our lives. And I think as well, just thinking about Christchurch Central in the future, and we want to carry on being a church for people who don't go to church. And Christchurch Walkley really does want to reach people living in and around Walkley. And you know, we are in God's plan. We know we are. If you look at the end of Luke's Gospel, Luke chapter 24, verses 46 and 47, Luke tells us that it is written, that it was planned, it was God's purpose, God's will, that Jesus Christ should come and suffer and die and rise again. That's verse 46. Verse 47 goes on and says, and, that is, it is as much God's purposes and plans, it is written. Verse 47 goes on to say, the forgiveness be preached in Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, to the ends of the earth. So people know. So as we venture forward in trying to reach people with understanding the kindness of God that we see in Ruth chapter 3, we know we're doing God's business. So we can afford to venture out in godliness and with courage. I want to end just by coming back a little bit more to that idea of hope, though. I want to quote John Piper, Christian leader from America. I first read these words on July the 8th, 2011, when I was going through some of my own kind of like a little personal despair. You know, we all go through moments like that, and I took a couple of days out away from the family, and someone lent me a car, and I was lent a cottage, and I went to the Lake District, and I sat on my own, and the first half day, I thought, well, this is the worst decision I've made in my life, when you're not feeling so hot, and stuff to figure out, what a dumb thing to do, you know, come here and sit on my own. I read these words, and they come out of Ruth chapter 3, and I hope they give you courage, I found them stirring for me. It's all about strategic righteousness and planning and hope. I hope and pray that they will hit you for your family and your personal circumstances. I don't know where everyone is in this room, but when I say I know where some of you are, and I know that things aren't plain sailing, you know I'm talking about you. And I don't want you losing hope. And I don't want to lose hope. Keep trusting God. And so here's some words from another preacher, a much better preacher than me. One of the terrible effects of depression is the inability to move purposefully and hopefully into the future. Naomi awakens to the kindness of God. Her hope comes alive and then overflows in strategic righteousness. She begins to plan righteousness and figure out how to do things in a godly way for the future. One of the reasons we should help each other hope in God is that only hopeful people, hopeful families, and hopeful churches plan and strategize. I feel a special calling to impart hope to the church I serve. Churches that feel no hope develop a maintenance mentality and just go through the motions year in, year out. But when a church feels the sovereign kindness of God hovering overhead and moving, hope starts to thrive. And righteousness, get this, righteousness ceases to be simply the avoidance of evil and becomes active and strategic. We begin to think and pray and plan. How can I be more godly? How can I be involved? How can I be praying for someone else to come to know Christ? How can we grow another church? How can our church grow into the future in a hope-filled, positive way? If we don't have hope, we just slip into depression. And we may as well just give up. So may we have the hope that Naomi has begun to develop and see and share with us 3,000 years later, as we tonight have read Ruth chapter 3. Let's spend a moment of quiet, shall we? Just a moment for us to pause to reflect in our own lives about hope and trusting God's kindness in whatever our personal circumstances, trusting God's kindness as well to continue with us as a church as we move into the future.